Hello, welcome again to Comic Con Stories. Of course, I'm my co-host, JT for Saskatoon.
Oh, lordy.
Also with us is Red Ink.
Yo.
And tonight, we're going to do a special celebration, a salute to the unsung partners of creative collaborations. Be it the Bill Fingers out there, the Jack Kirby's, the Michael Reeves out there. You know, the people that we're the ones brave enough to say, no, let's move this another direction, and ultimately saved these franchises when they were at their most vulnerable.
Jack Kirby thing is a different story. That's true.
I mean, Jack Kirby is an extreme example where people were able to very early figure out what was going on.
It's not that. It's comics back then weren't worth the fucking paper they were printed on. Nobody gave a living shit about them. So they created a character named Stan Lee who wrote all the comics and created all the comics because the fans wanted to talk to him. And this Stan Lee happened to be played by somebody. Who today still takes credit for doing all that, despite he never did it.
Yes.
See, growing up, like, one of the biggest things we can talk about right away, and I mean, might as well go swing for the fences, is Bill Finger. Now,
yes. Have you seen the documentary Batman and Bill?
Not as of yet. I haven't been able to find it, but that's what a lot of people have told me. But like growing up, like I knew of Bill Finger. In fact, I for many years as a kid mistakenly thought of Bill Finger as the artist and Bob Kane as the writer on Batman.
Well, technically, Finger did do some art.
Well, yeah, but I mean, he's primarily known as a writer, and he is. You know, he is the Schuster to Kane Siegel, if you will. But like, I honestly, like, I didn't know, like, I knew Bill Finger was like a co-creator of Batman, and you know, even, but I didn't really know the history of, you know, Bob Kane pulling a pre-Stan Lee and like taking all the credit and how he worked the deal so it's Batman created by Bob Kane, not Batman created by Kane and Finger and all that until years later. And that definitely took some shine because, I mean, Bob Kane, because he created Batman, he was a huge hero in my eyes. And, I mean, he still is to a degree, but, you know, it took a lot of shine off of that, you know, as the wool was pulled away and, you know, when I found out about Bill Finger and, you know, his history. I mean, most famously, one of the best stories about Bill Finger is how originally Bob Kane's idea for a Batman costume was a red bodysuit, black trunks, a domino mask, and this, you know, Leo da Vinci-style glider on his back. And then Bill was like, no, just no. And then he came up with the original, like, yeah, with the purple gloves and the ears going off left and right, which is... You know, that's an homage that they worked into the design of Batman on Justice League and Justice League Unlimited with that kind of exaggerated cowl that they had there. That's a nod to the original Golden Age Batman design, which is something Finger came up with. I know. Did you know about Bill Finger right from the start, Red, or did you find out later about how he kind of got screwed over in the deal by Kane?
It wasn't until the internet came around that I learned all this shit. So, as a kid, I pretty much thought Bob Kane created Batman, and that was it.
As for me, I had a mentor who pretty much lived in the industry, so he told me outright the stuff about the original Batman wore a red union suit until Bill Finger said, let's rework this. Most of the Batman mythos was created by Bill Finger. Like the early season stuff about the stuff with Alfred was Bill Finger. The stuff with the Joker was Bill Finger. I mean, without all that stuff, you have had this guy in a red union suit gliding from building to building, almost like a proto Kite Man, honestly.
You can't really give the credit for all that to Bill Finger. You can give that really to Walter Gibson.
Okay.
He's the one who created all that mythos. Bill Finger ripped it off. In case you don't know who Walter Gibson is, he's the guy who created The Shadow.
The Shadow, yes, you are technically right. A lot of the early Batman mythos is a ripoff of The Shadow.
It's not just a ripoff, it's what they call a swipe in the industry. He traced the fucking Shadow comics for about probably the first 10 or 12 issues or something like that.
You gotta keep in mind, Finger and Kane, who split artistic duties, were not the best artists. I mean, they were instrumental in what they did, but they were like B to C team on like artistic ability even back then.
Mm-hmm. But the true unsung hero of Batman is Walter Gibson.
I think I had seen, was it somewhere as recently as the Razor Fist on YouTube, is somebody you put me on to, Ben, with some of his more eloquent rant videos. He has a video looking at the Shadow comics, and he spends at least 5 minutes just kind of taking, you know, the memory of Kane to task for, you know, all those shenanigans.
Well, the biggest thing you have to remember with Kane is when Kane was like driving around the $1 million cars, when the Batman TV show was at its heyday, and he was writing that like a pony to the bank, you know, meeting with celebrities at night, wearing very expensive suits. You know, Bill Finger was wasting away, dying in a cramped one bedroom tenement in New York with pneumonia, and it was basically that's how he died. I mean, the saddest thing is the death of Bill Finger, because he died. He doesn't even have a grave. What happened was he was cremated. His son went to the beach, traced out a bat symbol on the sand, poured his father's ashes into the symbol, and let the water wash it away. That is the death of Bill Finger.
That is really fucking sad. Like, seriously, like, Bob Kane's a dick.
Well, technically, Bob Kane is also how the Finger family eventually was able to get the co-created rights back. Because there was an interview in 67, I believe. We need citation to be sure, but there was an interview, a recorded interview, Bob Kane's voice saying, the majority of it is owed to Bill Finger.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, like, whatever their relationship was at the time, but you'd think, like, they've created this cultural touchstone, you know, kind of solidified comic books as an American art form. You think you could have helped your brother out there, Bobby? You know, that's all I'm saying. Like,
see, but...
go ahead, Red.
Oh. I don't mean to interrupt, JT, sorry.
No, go ahead. I was pretty much done. I would have started rambling.
Oh. See, what I've studied up on Bob Kane is that he's an egomaniac. I've seen, like, this is just basically fucking, like, what I'm repeating right now is, what do you call, telephone? Mm-hmm. So it's somebody who heard something, but it's somebody who was close to them. It's not somebody who was just out of nowhere. Is that Bob Kane was obsessed with getting the rights to Batman and all that shit, and he basically was cutting everybody out and taking 100% credit and all that shit. I don't know if he did this during the 67 Batman series or if he did it before that, but from what I heard is he was a major egomaniac. He couldn't stand the fact that other people were taking credit for Batman.
Okay, I'll wait until you finish this sentence, and then I'll add my 2 cents. I apologize.
He wanted to be the one guy known for Batman. All right, I'm done.
Okay, so he was so completely narcissistic, he could not countenance to ever sharing the spotlight with somebody.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I heard, but I can't say 100% that it's true. I might be spreading a rumor saying that, but
yeah.
It's unbelievable if you watch the documentary. I mean, the sad thing is, as his death was, his cremation, his ashes on the ocean, that actually is more uplifting than for 20 years people believed Finger died and was just thrown into a Potter's Field grave. Which is basically, you know, the practice of people who are poor, who don't have the ability to pay for their own funeral, they're just thrown in a mass grave in unmarked. Just, you never know who's in there.
Yeah, because that's like what they did in the G.I. Joe comics in the, I think it's sometime in the first 3 or 4 years, like where they had the Cobra Scientist, Dr. Venom, and when he was eventually offed by, I think it was Quinn the Eskimo or Snake Eyes, that like they just buried him in a pauper's grave, and he was like second body down in a stack of 3 in one hole.
So,
you know, like I said, that sort of thing.
As sad as Finger's death was, I mean, it's better than people thought for years. I mean, and it was actually thanks to his son Fred that there's actually the co-created credit now, because his son Frederick, who was gay, actually did have a daughter, Athena, and Athena was the one that was instrumental, because a living heir is the only thing you need to sue for a co-created credit. And there's this one journalist who searched for 30 years for an heir of Bill Finger's and found Athena, and it's because of Athena that there's that co-create credit now.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about some other of these people, because if we want to talk, let's talk about Star Wars.
What about Star Wars?
Because there's an unsung hero of Star Wars that I think is definitely someone we need to talk about, because George Lucas was married to a film editor in his early days, Marcia Lucas, and isn't that cute? She knows how to edit film and she went to film school. No, she was a skilled film editor. Martin Scorsese wanted her to work on his films. That's how good she was. I mean, she did work on Taxi Driver, for crying out loud. She's not like, oh, isn't that cute? She's a film editor. No, she was the film editor.
Not only that, she performed miracles. Like, some of George Lucas's movies were completely unintelligible when he made them, and it's because she pieced together the good bits, put it all together, and even made it all make sense. Yes. Is how she saved those movies.
The original original theatrical studio cut of Star Wars was an unwatchable mess. Marcia Lucas, in the editor's bay, pulled off what is considered a minor miracle, turning something that was barely, for cable sci-fi into this multi-million dollar franchise just from her sweat and tears in the editing bay. She's the kind of person that would turn to George and challenge him, say, are you serious, George? Do you really want to do that? She told George Lucas, you don't know how to relate to people. And he took that as a challenge, and he made American Graffiti because she told him that.
Not just that, she edited American Graffiti and actually helped him make it fucking relate to people.
You're right. You're absolutely right. The point is, if you look at the list of the movies she's edited, and you see a stark line. Like, her career ends in 1983 with Return of the Jedi. That is the last film she edited. Her story is somewhat sad, too. Basically, when Skywalker Ranch was being built, Lucas pretty much made her in charge of the library of Skywalker Ranch. That's it. He made her a bird stuck in a bird cage. She no longer could work on films. She was stuck in this bird cage. And she basically had to just sit there and look pretty. And it was really sad for her. When Skywalker Ranch was being built, she took her first opportunity to leave. She actually divorced George and married the guy who was in charge of the architecture of the library, honestly. First guy she could find. And it's really sad that she's not back in the film editing because, again, like I said, she was not just an editor.
She died.
Was the editor. No, she's alive.
I heard she died of cancer.
No, she's still alive. She's 72 years old, but she's still alive. I just think her experience with George soured her to filmmaking so much that she doesn't want to touch another reel of film. Which is so sad to me because, again, this woman was an artist with film editing. Like, you would not believe. And this also is actually the sad little truth about the special editions that no one wants to talk about. The Star Wars special editions, it may look like the exact same cuts as the theatrical cut, but there's like a couple times when some cuts are 1 or 2 seconds difference. Like every cut of the film is different by like 1 to 2 seconds from the original prints. And there's a reason for this. Because George did this with the special editions, Marsh's credit as editor is gone. Because he technically recut it.
That's not 100% true.
Okay.
Yes, her credit is gone, but he didn't do it. He might have done it for that reason, but he didn't entirely do it for that reason.
It's not entirely for that reason, but I bet you that's one of the factors in it.
The main reason is the movies had to be different enough that George Lucas could own them. Because Fox owns the original cuts of Star Wars. Well, Disney does now, since they bought Fox. But the original cuts that everybody loves and everybody begged Lucas to re-release, were, he couldn't because 20th Century Fox owned them.
Huh.
So he had to make, in order to release the special editions, he had to make them just different enough legally so that he owned them.
I honestly really think that the saddest thing is Star Wars actually got an Academy Award for film editing. Best film editing, 1977. And the Academy Award for that is technically for a version of the film that no longer exists. And I feel bad for Marcia Lucas. I really do, because this is a person who, like I said, I really wished stayed in film because, oh my God, she was amazing, and I feel bad that her entire life was upended by was essentially a petty little man. JT, your thoughts?
That's just like with the special editions, and I mean, there's one thing of sticking to your vision and wanting to see your creative expression fulfilled like that, and I can understand that, but did he not know by doing the special editions he was like that is a dick move to like put these things on and say, no, this is the definitive vision. I mean, you're undercutting all her hard work, you're basically giving her the middle finger. Like, why, George, why?
George is a bit of a petty man. I mean, you should hear some of the stories about him.
Have you seen his interviews with regarding the new Star Wars shit?
Yeah.
He's so petty that he just can't believe that they're doing Star Wars without him. Like, what did he think? They're going to give him, like, a couple billion dollars and still let him work on Star Wars? No.
I love how he's like, I gave them notes. I gave them all these fantastic notes, and they're gonna follow it. They're going to follow my vision. And they're like, as soon as he leaves the room, they throw the notes in the fucking wood chipper.
Yeah. I think it was more like Homer Simpson when they throw his underwear in the fire. Pretty much.
Now, one guy I would like to mention, and he's by no means unsung at all, but is definitely a creator that I don't think people know a lot about. Well, two guys. The first one that springs to mind is Bill Mantlow, you know, creator of Rocket Raccoon, writer and creator of ROM Space Knight. He was the writer on the Micronauts, which was my first introduction to his writing when I was a kid. And you don't realize, like, that's one of the things I like about the internet is, like, you might like a certain writer or artist, but not necessarily know all the stuff they've worked on. And, you know, I knew I loved Micronauts. I knew I liked ROM. You know, I didn't really know about Rocket until they brought him to the forefront in, like, the Marvel Cosmic Revolution years ago. But to know that there was, like, this one guy was responsible for two of my favorite comics as a kid, and then to hear his story of, you know, what happened with the car accident and the brain damage and all that, you know, it's...
I mean, one thing I had to say about this, there is a positive to this, because Marvel did him a solid by giving him a pre-released viewing of Guardians.
Oh, yeah, now I've seen those pictures. They're like, he's got the big childlike smile on his face, and somebody, I don't know who, I forget who, but somebody made him like a plushy Rocket in the red and blue Guardians outfit from the comic books, you know, and might have just been a fan. I mean, stuff like that, but I mean, you look at character, like stuff like the Micronauts, which is based on a Japanese toy line, Microman, and you know, Rocket Raccoon, it's a talking raccoon with a laser rifle and a gun fetish. I mean, there are certain things in comics that just ring true for fans. And it's just, once you learn his story, you look at all he's created in life, and it's just, how did no one really recognize this before? It's like, no one might have not really given that much of a rip unless he had that accident. And I think that's just kind of a ignorance on a lot of fans' part, that you know, we don't really, like, we're such creatures of instant gratification now that we don't think of the hard work and mental wear and tear that goes into creating, you know, these works of art like this. And another creator that I don't think has gotten, I don't think he's received his proper due. Like, he's gotten some props, but, you know, Steve Ditko. I mean,
absolutely Steve Ditko, but part of it is Ditko's own self-imposed
The objectivism, right?
Well, no, his own self-imposed exile from the industry, because you got to keep in mind that you know, people like Bill Finger and you know, even in the case of someone like Jack Kirby, are people who were very vocal in the con circuit. I mean, Bill Finger went to cons still and still talked to people and told people about his experiences, even when he was in failing health. He still made the point that the reason why people talked about Bill Finger was because Bill Finger talked about Bill Finger. I mean, that's the honest truth. I mean, it's different because of that.
Well, certainly, but I mean, you look at the guy, like, you recognize the very, you know, reedy art style is how I want to describe it on Spider-Man, where you know, he was thin and gangly, and he looked like a spider crawling on the walls. And you look at, like, you don't even have to drop acid. In fact, it might enhance the experience of reading, like, early, was it Tales of Suspense that Doctor Strange showed up in? Or is it just Strange Tales? It's like the book where he split the half of it was him, and the other half was, like, the thing in the Human Torch. But I mean, you look at Steve Ditko's art on Doctor Strange, especially when he drew stuff like the Dark Dimension. You know, it's just like there is a certain amount of genius and madness that went to everything when he put, you know, pen to page like that. And then there's like the like his whole philosophy is was I correct in calling it objectivism?
Yes.
Is that, yeah, like how maybe you can explain that, because I have an idea of what that is, but I know it comes off of like Ayn Rand's work.
Yeah, and the funny thing about Ditko is the band actually has a legitimate bag of holding. You walk up to Ditko, and you might be a total stranger, and you say, "Hey, Steve Ditko, I love your work." He'll shake your hand with a big smile. He'll open up this bag and give you a copy of Atlas Shrugged.
Every time.
I am not fucking around. He does this. He actually does this. And there's actually a documentary like called Finding Steve Ditko, where at the end the interviewer talks to Steve Ditko, and this happens. The Ditko reaches into a bag, pulls out a copy of Atlas Shrugged, and gives it to the guy. Ditko loved objectivism because objectivism explains, basically, objectivism is basically the celebration of man for the accomplishments of man, and the idea that things are as they are, that things are as you view them, that there is no gray and moral ambiguity. Things are either right or they're wrong.
So black and white.
Yes. Or A is A, as Ditko would later put it.
I heard some stories about Ditko, like, he would use the original drawings of Spider-Man to test how sharp his paper cutter was.
He did. He used them as cutting mats.
Yeah.
You got to keep in mind that Ditko had a big falling out with Stan Lee, because of the fact that Ditko was an objectivist libertarian, while most of the Marvel bullpit was honestly very, very, very liberal at the time. I mean, the honest truth is, if you want to talk about the most conservative people in comics, your answers would be Steve Ditko, who's a libertarian, more center than left or right, Chuck Dixon, and possibly Wally Wood. Everyone else was a raging liberal back then. Today, still too, to some degree. And because of that, Ditko just let his art speak for him versus let him himself speak, because whenever he spoke, he talked about he was an evangelist of objectivism. I'll just put it that way. He was an evangelist. Whenever you talked to him about it, he had to let you know what he thought. And I think that was part of his downfall. Great artist, though. I mean, he wanted to take Spider-Man down that route a little bit, at least. Because when he envisioned Spider-Man, he envisioned that there was no ambiguity, that even by not taking action, you're doing evil. Which, if you think about Spider-Man's origin, you know, fits in there somewhat, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like the whole great power, great responsibility.
Yeah.
The whole, why didn't you stop him? All you had to do was trip him. I mean, it's also his whole objectivism that goes to create, like, when he went to work for Charlton Comics, you know, later on in the 60s, like, when he kind of, after he departed Marvel, and created, like, the character of the Question.
Well, more than was, just the Question, I mean, if you look at Hawk and Dove as well.
Hawk and Dove for the, you know, Distinguished Competition, but I mean, as much as, like, he did create them the same, but, I mean, when you think, like, the bet, like, if you were to walk up to a comic fan who knows some stuff and ask him, you know, what is the character that Steve Ditko created? You know, what character do you most associate with Steve Ditko? 9 times out of 10, people probably say Spider-Man if they know their history, but there is going to be at least 1 or 2 people that may say the Question because of, like, you know, the whole, like, Vic Sage did not, you know, he held to that, like, if you're a bad guy, you're a bad guy. There's no moral gray area. You know, like, that's his philosophy. Is something I always kind of appreciated of the Shadow. But, you know, I still, again, like Bill Mantlow and Bill Finger, you know, later on once the internet came out, I did a little digging and found out all this stuff about Steve Ditko. Like, and so much more of his life became more interesting to me, not more than his work, but as equally interesting. You know, his life was just as interesting as his creations.
Well, let's talk about the Spider-Man, because there's several different origin stories of how Spider-Man was created. Let's talk about them. In 2002, in an interview, Stan Lee said that he came up with the idea of Spider-Man by watching a fly climb a wall.
What?
I swear to God, I can show you this interview. It was an extra to the. Let's see here.
I have a book by Stan Lee that fucking describes something completely different.
This was an extra on the Sam Raimi 2002 Spider-Man DVD. It's an interview with Stan Lee where he says this. I swear to God, I have this on video. And Red's going to say the other published version of the origin.
Now, keep in mind, Stan Lee has said some crazy things.
Yes, he has.
Like, he's claimed that he helped create Captain America.
He was about 14 years old at the time, so that's a lie.
He's about 13, 14 years old, yeah.
I could tell you the true story about how he was involved with Timely Comics back then. But let's that's a different tangent. Go ahead, Red, on the origin of Spider-Man as per Stan Lee, circa early before 2002.
I can't really remember it. It was just basically he was talking to his wife, and all of a sudden the idea of Spider-Man just came to him.
All right. Now, let me tell you the version of the origin that Jack Kirby, Joe Simon, Steve Ditko, and probably three other people who were in the room at the time say was the real origin. So, around the time of Captain America's creation, there was a sketch that Joe Simon came up with and was pretty much shuttered away. No one wanted to talk about it because the idea was unfinished. It was a half-baked idea. Joe Simon himself even says this is a half-baked idea. And what I'm talking about is Joe Simon's Silver Spider.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard of this, but I'm not sure.
Silver Spider was basically a lot like Captain Marvel. It was a little boy who put on a ring that turned him into an adult superhero with the powers of the spider. And
see, I heard about this before. When I was a kid, I heard about this, and I heard that the character was actually Creative Commons. So I remember as a kid, I wanted to actually make a comic about it.
So, what happened was this, was a lot of the early Silver Spider drawings were handed to Ditko and said, hey, make something with this. Ditko admits this is what happened.
Mm.
Joe Simon said this is what happened. Jack Kirby said this is what happened. The only person who said this isn't how it happened is Stan Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm just putting it out there. I mean, either three people are right and Stan Lee is wrong, or Stan Lee is right and everyone else got it wrong.
Well, I think Red.
Go ahead, Red.
No, I just said Excelsior.
Yes. So, there's another unsung hero I want to talk about. Actually, two of them. Because I think these two people are people that no one talks about, but have done such an amazing contribution, maybe not to comic books directly, but to definitely comic-related media. I'm talking about Frank Parr and Michael Reeves. And instantly I can tell people like, who the fuck are these two guys? Frank Parr is, like I said, he's an unsung hero, but same with Michael Reeves. These two people are the people that helped certain two cartoon series early on, early get their start off the ground. Michael Reeves and Frank Parr were both consultants and head writers on Batman the Animated Series and Gargoyles.
Oh, really?
Yes, both of them. Biggest thing you have to keep in mind is, when you, especially with specifically with Gargoyles, before Frank Parr and Michael Reeves got their hands on it, it was going to be like gummy bears.
I actually seen an interview from what's his face?
Weissman,
where he describes Gargoyles as gummy bears, but more intellectual.
I think I've seen that video. Isn't that the one where you see like the art mocked up where Goliath has got like a scarf and a hat pulled low on his head and a trench coat and he's sitting on like a park bench, or you have another shot of him like sitting in a high back chair reading Shakespeare in the library when he's talking about like his original pitch for Gargoyles?
Yeah, that's the one.
You know, I'm not saying it wouldn't have worked. It just wouldn't have been nearly as awesome.
And like I said, these two guys are very little credits given to them, even though if you look at their credits, they're always like that helping hand coming in to like sort of nudge something in the right direction. Like they're the invisible hand that like be like, you know, maybe this would be better if we do X. You know, Frank Parr especially, because, I mean, these people have a long line of credits where they're the invisible guiding hand on some of the better cartoon-related comic medias. And I feel like their story hasn't been told yet. And a big part of it is, you know, Bruce Timm, give the man a lot of credit. He is a fantastic character designer. He's a fantastic designer for animation. But, you know, without people like Frank Parr, Michael Reeves, and even to an extent Paul Dini, you know, sort of like reining him in on some things, you know, we wouldn't have gotten the series that we did because again, like, the same thing with Greg Weissman. Because Weissman's later series don't have the same amount of restraint that I think came from because of these two men. Like, the first five episodes of Gargoyles were written by Michael Reeves. And I think that in itself establishes Michael Reeves created most of the lore of Gargoyles.
Well, with Weissman, my observations of him through the years is he loves to take credit for things, even though it's multiple people helping him out. And you can see what happens when people don't rein him in. Because he loves to create fan fiction. And then he goes to conventions and he reads his fan fiction. And it's fucking awful. It's cringeworthy. It's like a 14-year-old child's dream.
Wet dream.
Pretty much. Like, I used to go on the forums and I admit it in public, but I used to troll Greg Weisman's fucking forums when I was younger. And I constantly used to fucking say shit like, I think it was, what do you call it? Not Gargoyles, not Teen Titans.
Spectacular Spider-Man, The Crap Man,
No, yeah, it was, I wasn't actually trolling at this time, but I went to the forums, and Young Justice had just ended, and I said, just watch, he's going to create a fan fiction where the Gargoyles, Spectacular Spider-Man, and Young Justice all team up.
And he did.
And everybody was like, no, he's not going to do that. He made that first fan fiction where the Spectacular Spider-Man and Gargoyles meet up out of depression. He's not going to do it again.
Boy, were they wrong.
Pretty much.
They all had sex.
Ugh, it got even cringeworthier than that because, yeah, he did that After Hours fucking podcast bullshit where he put on a fake mustache and he was evil Greg Weisman. He's like, and he fucking did these stupid, cringeworthy fucking answered cringeworthy questions. Like, did Artemis ever have sex?
And, then, yeah, and he's like, yeah, she has shit ton of sex. He fucks everybody. And I'm like, okay. Don't tell people that.
That's exactly what I said, because I'm like, isn't she fucking 14 years old?
Well, you got the fucking part right.
But still, telling your audience a 14-year-old girl is sexually fucking active is not a good thing.
I mean, it gets even creepier because he says that the Connor and Miss Martian have the wacky, freaky shapeshifter sex.
And he also said that Impulse and fucking Blue Beetle are gay for each other.
I bet that made Mark Waid happy.
Like, two guys can't have a bromance, it's just gotta be gay?
Exactly.
Okay, so... Matt, like, what else has Reeves worked on that I would possibly know, Ben?
All right, I will let you know. But again, I think the fact that Michael Reeves has, you know, if you look at, he wrote the first five episodes of Gargoyles, and he wrote the majority of season two episodes as well. In and of itself is like, just, you know, shows his credit on that. But he's worked on everything. I mean, he's worked on. He's worked on cartoons both good and bad. He's worked on the He-Man and the Masters of the Universe reboot in the early aughts. He worked on Centurions. He's done some regular work too. He's worked on the Gargoyles cartoon series. He's worked on Real Ghostbusters, Space Sentinels. I mean, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I mean, he's worked on a lot of stuff.
Space Sentinels?
Yes.
Which one's that?
It's the one that's like Space Sentinels is like Space Rangers but run in America.
Okay, I'm gonna have to look that up after we're done. That sounds interesting.
But again, like I said, this guy is more the invisible hand. Frank Parr is a showrunner in the waiting because if you look at Frank Parr was pretty much the one of the guiding hands of X-Men Evolution. He wasn't quite the as people would say the the showrunner like Bruce Timm was, but he definitely was near the top.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Huh. And like I said, I feel like nobody talks about these guys nearly as much as they talk about Greg Weisman and Bruce Timm. And, Bruce Timm's not quite at the level of Greg Weisman of if he's left to his own devices, da-da-da-da-da, but he's getting there. He's getting there.
Oh, he makes some creepy-ass fucking shit.
No, you're right, like, but he still creates a better product than Weisman does solo, is all I'm saying.
Like... There are episodes that Greg White, not Greg, that Bruce Timm had full control over, and you can see it on the fucking, on the Batman series. Like, the baby doll episode. Fuck it. It's so fucking creepy. And his fingerprints are all over that fucking episode. Both of those episodes. Because one of them's even creepy.
You're talking about the one where her and Croc kind of have some kind of weird relationship?
Yeah. Okay. I know she's a 40-year-old woman, but she still looks like she's fucking 4 years old, and it's creepy.
Basically, if you're see them, it's like, stop that shit, it's nasty.
Pretty much.
But like I said, still not, Weissman, like, comes off as downright autistic at times, though, compared to Timm. Is all I'm saying is Timm can still create a good product to... Well, arguably a good product. Well, Weissman, if he's left his own devices, would just, like, do so much freaky shit. Because the sad thing is Weissman would actually love talking about gargoyle sex. I mean, it's the creepiest shit ever. I think it's one of those After Dark things he did where he talked about nothing but gargoyle sex.
Do we really need to speak about gargoyle sex?
He seemed to need to, so...
That doesn't make it necessary, Ben.
So, yes, so, like I said, Frank Parr, Michael Reeves, I think, are two of these people, like the people, you know, behind the scenes, doing a lot of heavy lifting. You know, basically, they're the guys that we should be talking more about. You know, Frank Parr, Michael Reeves. What do you think, Red?
I think you got a point, yeah.
And again, I think it's understandable about Michael Reeves' contribution to Gargoyles. He wrote the first five episodes. The majority of Gargoyles' lore came from the first five episodes. There's no way to ignore the fact that if it wasn't for Michael Reeves, there wouldn't be Gargoyles' lore.
No, it's you can't really argue against that. I mean, there's other guys that, you know, like, you know, go back to Stan Lee for a second. I mean, the whole Lee and Kirby thing, I mean, you'd be stupid to not know about Kirby's contributions to the art form of comic books, both for Marvel and DC and all the independent stuff in between. But, you know, until you become a little more learned in the ways of comic nerddom, you know Jack Kirby to be a very talented artist, but you know, until you discover the fourth world, you just don't really have an idea of how deep this man's imagination went. I mean, because when you look at stuff like the fourth world and, you know, how he saw the concepts of good and evil and, like, abstract thought and how he had, like, that almost perfect sync between mind and his hand, because, like, what he saw in his head, he was able to put down in the page. But you don't, a lot of times, you don't notice that. Because, you know, Stan Lee's on his soapbox crowing about how he created 90% of the Marvel Universe, and however much of that is actively true, you know, it's difficult to say, but I just don't think sometimes, like, Kirby is recognized as one of the greats, but I just don't think a lot of people know how great he is or how much he's given us. What do you think of that? Do you think that'd be fair to say on some level?
I think comic book fans know. It's your average Joe doesn't know, is what I think.
Yeah. I think that's kind of what I was trying to say there. Is like, yeah, comic fans know. Not every comic fans know until, like I said, you get a few notches on your belt. But, you know, you look at stuff like the X-Men movies. You know, you look at, you know, Thor and Iron Man and the Avengers, like stuff that Kirby worked on back in the day, but no one, I just don't think people really realize that how much of their childhoods kind of sprang forth from the mind of Jack Kirby. And I think he should be recognized as such. So, and is there anybody else is there anybody you can think of in particular, Red, that maybe isn't as well known as they should be?
There's lots of people, but without studying for it first, I can't really bring it up.
Yeah. I think honestly, there's one guy I want to talk about that's, I mean, the stuff he made isn't revolutionary or even like, oh my God, this is amazing. But I feel like what he did do was basically work on lots of stuff that's average at best to terrible, and did the best he could with what he had. Another one of these invisible hands trying, maybe not succeeding, but trying to guide these shows in the right direction. I'm talking about the animator and animation director Bob Richardson. Bob Richardson is an interesting fellow. I mean, he worked in the industry for many years. I mean, this is a guy who I believe he actually did some work on the Jungle Book, the original Disney Jungle Book. He pretty much finished his career on Fox's King of the Hill. So this is a guy who has a long history and a long career of just working on the animation as a whole. One of his stops in his career was in 1994. He worked on the Fox Spider-Man cartoon with egomaniac John Semper. And I find this really sad for Richardson, because Semper, in interviews, went out of his way to slander Richardson, saying the show's lack of quality is because of Richardson and only Richardson. and the anything good in the show is due to Semper and only Semper, in Semper's eyes. And I think that that's a really sad thing for me, because Richardson, like I said, he's not like one of these creative powerhouses, but he's a guy that's a workhorse. He did a lot of work behind the scenes on lots of great shows and lots of okay shows, but this is a guy you could count on to like do the job and do it right. And if anything, the show's budgetary problems were more of a fault of the show, and Semper's ridiculous demands to the show were what sunk the show more so than Bob Richardson doing a 9-to-5 working every day trying to do a good product. Because the sad thing is the show actually had lots of talent on it. Like, who was the one storyboard artist you saw do storyboards for the show, Red?
Gordon. All right, Stephen E. Gordon, the guy who did the X-Men Evolution designs.
Yes. And if you look at the original storyboards, the original storyboards before they were altered, Peter Parker looked like comic book Petey. He had the two bangs on the sides. You know, he actually looked. I mean, a lot of it actually looked pretty good. And what happened was, for people who don't know, what happened was John Semper walked in and made a demand of the animation team to, in the nth hour, change Peter Parker's design.
Huh.
Well, it was because he wanted to make him look like Nick Hammond.
Yes.
Because the only Spider-Man he knew about was Nick Hammond, Spider-Man.
Yes.
The live-action 60s show that only lasted like 3 episodes.
And I thought it actually got more than that, but whatever.
And it's actually really kind of sad. You'll see pictures of... there's this picture of Nick Hammond in black and white wearing a stripy shirt holding a camera as Peter Parker. And you look at it, and you can't unsee it because it looks exactly like the character models for Petey in the 94 cartoon.
But if you watch the series, he's not wearing the green and white and blue stripey. It's brown in this TV shirt. Like, he's wearing the sweater. It's just brown.
The pattern's the same, just a different color. And like I said, if you look at the original storyboards, Petey is 90s Peter Parker with the two bangs on the side. He's wearing the black jacket and the yellow shirt, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm Eddie Brock, and I got a leather jacket, and I'm a bad guy.
That's true. It's actually really sad because I would have loved to have seen this series as it was originally intended to look. Because something tells me that they had a lot of the right ingredients for this show. But something happened. And I think that something's name is John Semper, creator of Creeporia.
Creeporia?
The less you know, the better.
Red asked, and I showed him, and Red's sorry he asked.
It's fucking terrible.
It's the worst thing ever. But who are some other unsung heroes? The people like the in the back room doing the work who we don't give enough credit.
Again, when I think of guys like that, I can think of a couple of guys that they're not complete unknowns, but you know that I don't think it's. I can think of a few guys that just haven't gotten their due, like. Especially like web comic creators,
like me.
You know, like Ben, yes, our own Ben Carver, who, folks, he does his level best to do a. Sorry, I want to say do his very best to do a very almost too well thought out sometimes your web comic, Ben, but you know it's. You know, sometimes you put, like I said, sometimes you put a little too much thought into things, but it doesn't make it bad. But I'm thinking of guys like, I don't know if you guys ever read the online strip PvP.
Oh, please don't bring up Scott Kurtz.
Okay, why does everyone hate on Scott Kurtz?
Because he's a fucking cunt. I don't care if this is fucking, if we're recording this podcast. It's the truth. Scott Kurtz is a fucking cunt and he should burn in hell.
Oh, God.
Okay. Moving away from that.
Well, hold on. There's actually, you know, there's a lot of Scott Kurtz stories we could talk about now, so.
I just think for a guy who has been working for many years in the online community, and he definitely came up in that boom of video game-based web comics that started in, like, the early aughts, you know, I've always been a fan of PvP. Like, I've always enjoyed reading that strip. I mean, I've certainly heard stories myself of people not being fans of a creator, and I get that. I've certainly never even explode with venom and vitriol the way Red just did.
Well, okay, so, let me tell you a Scott Kurtz story. So, Scott Kurtz, PvP, creator PvP, is... he's in a pickle. He wants to increase his viewership, and he happens to know, personally know, a comic book artist named Frank Cho. And this is when Frank Cho was, like, doing New Avengers. So, Frank Cho, when he was at the height of his popularity. And he pretty much begged Frank Cho, please draw me a filler strip. Please, I beg you, Frank, draw me a filler strip. Do it for old times. And Frank Cho did. And it's of these two girls kissing each other. And it's done in a very Frank Cho-ish style. And basically, Scott Kurtz saw it, liked it, approved it, and put it on the website himself. And what happened was Scott Kurtz's father called him and said, son, I am disappointed. How dare you let Frank Cho draw this for you? And so in the link I put in the chat room, and I'll include in the show notes, is a podcast where Scott Kurtz says that, goes, God damn it, Frank, you're always doing this to me. And bitches about Frank Cho drawing him free art to promote his comic, and because his daddy doesn't like boobies.
Seriously?
I put the link on there. You can listen to it yourself. This happened.
There's so much more to that. Like, I've heard so many stories about him. Like, he loves to use people. The person you see on the podcast, on the Acquisitions Incorporated, where the Penny Arcade guys play Dungeons and Dragons, that's not really Scott Kurtz. That's him pretending to be a nice guy.
The honest truth is when they were doing when Penny Arcade was doing their game show of, hey, let's have these webcomic artists compete with each other, they had a segment where they're called How to Deal Trolls, and they had Scott Kurtz hosting the section. If I was on that show, I would continue heckling Scott Kurtz until he ran out of the room. And I said, there, I showed you how to deal with a troll.
You would heckle him until the man cried.
Considering Scott Kurtz, yes.
Well, if I was there, I would say, how do you deal with trolls, Scott? Do you go on your own forum under a fucking false identity and try to troll them back? Because that's what you did. You got caught doing it for it, too, because you're an idiot.
Don't change your IPs with a VPN.
Okay, so another online comic creator that I have been a fan of. Now,
if you don't say Chiselle Lugosi, I'm going to kick you off right now.
If you say Ryan Schomer, I will fucking kick you in the nuts.
He'll make the drive to do it, JT.
Well, then he better get going, because that's who I was going to mention.
I had a feeling you were going to fucking say it.
Look, I like Least I Could Do. It's been one of my favorite comic strip for years. And outside, I mean, I like the strip. I think he does some good work. Now, some of the side stuff he's tried to, like, the Kickstarter animated series that never fucking happened, you know, and then he's pissed that, you know, he went to Teletoon to get financing to make the least I could do cartoon series years ago. And then that fell through, but then they basically stole the idea and made The Dating Guy. And he's more pissed that they stole his idea, not that they stole his idea and did a poor copy of it. So if you don't know who Ryan Sommer is, folks, just look up the web comic strip Least I Could Do. It's a lot of sexual humor to start, but it's grown since then. I think it's a pretty decent, something that he's worked at for years. Some of his side stuff fell through, obviously. I'll let Ben speak about Giselle in a second. The last online comic that I think people should be aware of and the creator that people should be aware of, have either of you guys ever read Questionable Content? Jesus Christ, is there anything I could mention that not either of you are just going to let me talk about without
you talking? You asked me a question. And
yeah, it wasn't a yes or no answer. It's, oh, Christ.
Are you talking about the guy who drew porn and didn't know how to draw a vagina?
No, that's David Willis.
Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't going to bring up Shark Pack because I don't need to give Ben an aneurysm. Like, seriously, okay, what do you not like about Jeff Jocks and Questionable Content, Ben? God forbid I should mention something that I like that you don't complain about.
Stop liking things that I don't like.
Welcome to the internet, Red.
It's like there's nothing to it. I mean, it's like it's there, I guess. It doesn't, like, break any ground. It starts like any other webcomic I've seen where it's like two guys just talking, like it's like a Penny Arcade or a Mega Tokyo, and then it goes off into its own weird tangent. Now it's back to like people talking, and it doesn't do it for me.
Okay, so you're just not a fan of.
I
understand that. It's just, why did I get a oh god when I mentioned it?
Because it's honestly, it's only popular because of the time it came out. If it came out 2 years later, it would have drowned in a sea of, like, being, like, 98% of all the other comics that were out there at the time.
You know, versus a guy who kept at it, developed his fan base, and is now one of the few, if one of the only professional comic artists who actively makes a living by doing this.
There's a lot that make a living doing this.
Yeah, but I mean, just because you don't like where the story goes, does that denote?
I'm just admitting he's very, very lucky because he slipped in an early time of the industry. But like I said, if he was like if he started in 2005 versus 2003, he would have drowned in a sea of sameness. And I think that's fair to say. What do you think, Red?
I don't really know enough about Questionable Content. Never read it.
Okay. But let's sort of stop before this becomes a webcomic show, because I feel like...
Well, you're not going to bring up Giselle? Because, I mean, I just jumped...
I'm a big fan of Giselle Agosti. I think her artwork is basically... is Archie Comics through Adam Warren, if that makes sense.
It's Archie Comics with a lot more sex.
There was a lot of sex in Archie Comics to begin with, if you read between the lines.
Well, sometimes I think you read between too many lines, Ben.
That's why Jughead wears a crown.
Because he's Archie. He's the king of Archie's world.
Because he's uncircumcised. Yeah. Anyways, if we can't think of anything else, we might revisit this topic later, but I think we talked about a lot of the unsung heroes of the industry. Anyone else you want to bring up, guys?
I was going to bring up Frank Cho, but I think pretty much everybody knows about him by now.
All right.
Pardon me?
Fred?
Nobody can think of, like, I'd have to put more thought into it if we ever do this again.
All right. Well, then let's wrap this up. This is your host, Ben.
And JT from Saskatoon.
Red Ink.
And we're saying goodnight.
So long.
Peace out.